A weekend hurricane is still a monster, and despite being weekend, Hannah hit Texas hard. But we're still standing. This is the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
On a different kind of storm, this one in the Republican Party, why are some county Republican parties censuring the governor? Plus, you're about to hear one of the strangest stories in San Antonio's recent history. Speaking of strange, why were asylum-seeking children recently being held in a hotel? Another strange one, a brand new baseball stadium with cardboard cutouts instead of fans. Learn more when the Texas Standard begins. The news is first. Brace yourself. This one promises to be another big news week. It's Monday, July 27th, and this is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. I love how he often starts the show by saying, no matter where you are, I'll steal it. No matter where you are, you probably had your eyes on two things this weekend. The stimulus package, now dubbed CARES 2, and Hannah, the hurricane that weakened into a tropical storm, though there was nothing weak about a natural monster that flips 18-wheelers in a whim. More rain is expected to hit today in already highly saturated areas in the border region. Take, for instance, Brownsville, Texas. Noel Bernal is the city manager there, and he joins us now. Noel Bernal, thanks for speaking with the Texas Standard.
Thank you for inviting me.
You know, it's the middle of a crisis, and I want to know how everyone in Brownsville is doing.
Well, you know, let's talk about the hurricane first. So Hurricane Hannah just sweep through our region this weekend. You know, hurricanes are something that we know about here in Brownsville.
Yes.
We know we prepare for those quite well in terms of our emergency response planning and what we call continuity plans and disaster recovery plans. We know hurricanes. We're familiar with them. We
yes.
would prefer that we don't deal with them often, and we haven't down here in Brownsville, historically speaking. But, you know, if you compare it to COVID, COVID is the one crisis that we don't know, that you can't see, on a radar, that you can't determine how far it is from you and what some of the impacts could be so you can better adjust.
Absolutely. You know? I understand what you're saying. But is there any damage in your area that you saw as a result of Hannah?
We have some slight damage. Relatively speaking, some of the impacts were able to go off through the north of our area, but we had the rain was still around 6-7 inches.
Mm-hmm.
We had a tornado that did touch ground mm-hmm. around our airport area, which is the east side of the city. Some homes did suffer some damage.
Right.
There has been some isolated water damage just because of the volume of the water. But for the most part, you know, we did not lose life. We haven't had major impacts to property. And I would say that we have some debris management to focus on now. But for the most part, we did well with regard to Hurricane Hannah.
Did you have to move any people to emergency shelters? And I know that because of that, you know, when we talk about COVID and these types of situations where you have to put people in shelters, that presents an added challenge. And I wonder if that's something you faced.
There was a shelter that was open in our county. That shelter ended up getting, which was right outside of Brownsville. That shelter was ultimately closed and moved further north to Hidalgo County, which is where they needed more sheltering. So down here in Brownsville, sheltering was not as much of a need.
And I know that there's a lot of cases popping up with COVID-19. You know, how about that? There's an overwhelming reality in a way. When you're dealing with it in the middle of a global pandemic, and then you add the hurricane. And at the beginning of our conversation, you were telling me that that's precisely the fear, what you don't know, what you cannot see. Talk to me about that.
Well, in terms of the pandemic, you know, that's something that we've actually been very proactive about down here, here in Brownsville. Our local elected officials have provided tremendous leadership. They've been very proactive in terms of knowing who we serve and knowing our community challenges that are pre-existing that have, I believe, posed some additional challenges now that COVID has increased. The number of cases have increased down here. But COVID for us is something that we've done as much as we can based on the information that we've had. But I think the proactive planning on our part has been what we can allude to that we can control, so to speak. And for the most part, the community messaging, the partnerships with our local hospitals, the fact that the city has implemented pandemic planning frameworks, has we've had the first city operated drive-through down here, and we've done that because we need data. The cases that we've had here, we can attribute them to different spikes, different events that have happened, and the reopening of the economy by the state as well. There have been different triggers that have led to increases in cases. For us, it's more been an issue of how do we make sure that we can manage despite that, because at some point around May, early May, we kind of lost that ability to do local measures that were being effective up front. At this point, we are where we are, and we're managing the situation because we have information and data that's available to us through our local public health department that have allowed us then to build some partnerships so that we can ensure that our community is safe, that our businesses are continuing to function with our support and external resources, and that we're continuing to be proactive and innovative where we can to address the needs of our community.
I don't want to let you go without asking about you and your family. Are you well?
I've been very well, yes. We are just past the four-month mark that we've been teleworking. And I kind of go in and out and go to meetings there at City Hall as I need to, and try to get out and connect with our people, with our employees. But my family's well, and it's just part of what we call the new normal. I can report that we're healthy at home and healthy at work.
We've been speaking with Noel Bernal. He's the city manager in Brownsville, Texas. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a great day.
In Texas, members of the Republican Party normally show a united front. It's not that the party and its elected officials act as one, but yes, they normally show a united front. That's why it's worth mentioning that Texas Governor Greg Abbott is currently under fire from members of his own party over his response to the coronavirus outbreak. Eight county Republican parties have now formally censured him, saying his actions are a threat to their constitutional rights. KERA's Brett Jaspers takes a look at what the divisions could mean for the governor.
At the Republican Party of Texas's convention, Abbott knew he had to talk about his executive order that requires, in most cases, face masks in public.
I know that many of you do not like the mask requirement. I don't either. It is the last thing that I wanted to do. Actually, the next to last.
Abbott added the last thing he wants to do is impose another stay-at-home order, like the one he lifted in early May. But hardline conservatives in his party are rebelling over the mask order and other restrictions. They elected firebrand Alan West as the new leader of the state GOP.
Well, we have executive orders and mandates, people telling us what we can and cannot do, who is essential, who is not essential. It is time for us to stand up, and it's time for us to fight.
That's West in a video to the convention, which was held virtually, decrying what he calls the tyranny in Texas. One of the county Republican parties that censured Abbott is Llano County. Doug Sanders is chairman of the Llano GOP. He said Abbott's executive orders violate the state and federal constitutions and Republican Party principles.
And if he believes that restrictions ought to be placed on the citizens of Texas, then he needs to call a special session of the legislature.
And it may not just be what Abbott's doing, but how he's doing it. Russ Ramsey, executive editor of the Texas Tribune, says Abbott's inconsistency has opened him up to criticism.
The inconsistency of it makes it more difficult for, you know, a governor or a president or anybody else to kind of sell the idea that, hey, here's the problem, carefully described. Here are the remedies, carefully described. We're all in this together, and then just sort of keep going. We haven't had a consistent message like that.
But Abbott is probably still the state's strongest political force. His political committee has $38 million in the bank, and he's expected to use it this fall to defend Republican seats in the state House. And while two recent polls say that his popularity has slipped somewhat, both polls show more than 75% of Republicans still approve of his performance. Austin-based lobbyist Robert Miller says it's too early to pass judgment on how Abbott's handled this crisis.
After we're through this, I think that's the time to make judgments whether or not his leadership styles or his leadership characteristics were right for this time. And I think overall, they will prove to be correct.
The governor's office didn't respond to an email seeking an interview. The dissent among Republicans in Texas does come at a sensitive time, ahead of the November election, when Democrats have a real chance of taking the state House. As for whether anger at Abbott could keep Republican voters away from the polls this November, Representative Dan Flynn doesn't see that happening.
I think at the end of the day, when the presidential election heats up, when the Senate election heats up, that the people are going to recognize a distinct difference between the two parties.
Flynn just lost his primary runoff election in a conservative district, even though he was backed by the governor. And even if Abbott does lead Republicans to a strong finish in November, it doesn't mean he's in the clear. He could still face a Republican rival in his next gubernatorial primary. 2022 seems a long way off, but Doug Sanders of the Llano County GOP says anger over how Abbott handled the pandemic won't have died down.
The Republican party's moniker is an elephant, and elephants do not forget.
I'm Brett Jaspers in Dallas.
He's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Thank you so much for being here, Wells. How are you?
Hi, Joy. I'm doing great, and it's great to be here with you today. We're hearing from folks about the path of destruction wrought by Hurricane Hanna and the flooding it produced both along the coastal bend and in the Rio Grande Valley. As Steve Paris puts it on Facebook, this is the worst possible time for the RGV in South Texas to have a storm, thanks 2020, I think,
there,
obviously, to the coronavirus pandemic.
Yes.
For a more in-depth description of that damage, this is an interesting post on Facebook from the Brownsville Fire Department. They wrote, in the past 24 hours, the brave men and women of the Brownsville Fire Department responded to 122 incidents. Ooh. These incidents range from auto accidents, COVID-19 sick calls, downed power lines, flooded residences, reports of tornadoes, and even a ship fire near
the port
of Brownsville. Goodness gracious. And miraculously, Joy, Brownsville Fire goes on to say that fortunately, we have no reports of Hurricane Hanna-related injuries or deaths.
Yeah,
so
that has
good
been
on
a
that.
Silver
to be
lining.
Sure. Decidedly so. Keeping an eye on that and other stories from social media. So, I'll be back to chat with you in just a little bit, Joy.
Oh, I'm sure. You'll probably hear about that stimulus money. I don't know what you're doing today, but don't tune out. This is the Texas Standard. More to come.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz. The Texas Rangers started their season this weekend with two losses against just one win, but the bigger disappointment wasn't on the field. It was in the stands. Friday was opening day for Globe Life Field, a brand new $1.2 billion stadium in Arlington. But thanks to COVID-19, the seats will be empty this season, except for a few cardboard cutouts. And the cheers? Well, they came from recordings. KERA's Miranda Suarez reports on how baseball is trying to make a strange season seem as normal as possible.
When the Rangers move to a new stadium, watch out, because something always gets in the way. Players' strikes shortened the season when the team moved from D.C. to Texas in 1972, and again when they switched from Arlington Stadium to Globe Life Park in 1994. This year, the culprit is a pandemic. And although fans can't come to games, they can still get an in-person look at their team's new home by paying for a tour.
All right, everyone, we're going to keep on heading this way.
Hannah Kriebel wears a mask and a face shield as she guides a group of about a dozen people through the new stadium, Globe Life Field.
Last thing with social distancing and all the things that come with that, I'm going to ask that we try and refrain from touching things as much as possible and do not sit anywhere.
She points out a lot of improvements from the old ballpark across the street. The most important ones are a retractable roof and air conditioning. While crowds won't be able to enjoy these perks for a while, it's up to Chuck Morgan and his team to make the games feel as normal as possible for the players. Morgan is executive vice president of Ballpark Entertainment and the guy who delivers the team's signature line.
It is baseball time in Texas.
When somebody tells you, hey, it looks like we're not going to have any fans in the ballpark, you say, what do you mean we're not going to have fans in the ballpark? That's just not baseball. You got to have the fans cheering and eating their hot dogs and enjoying themselves at the ballpark, or it's not really baseball.
So a member of Morgan's team went through old Rangers games, grabbing hundreds of hours of crowd sound. Those recordings are piped through the stadium at the right moments. The same thing is happening at stadiums across the country. This is what it sounded like when new Ranger Todd Frazier came to the plate during Wednesday's exhibition game. The stands empty.
Yeah. And shoots this one in the air, right field, carrying pretty well. And that one is gone! Just over the 326 marker in the corner. A three-run shot for Frazier, and it's a new ball game.
And it almost sounds like a normal ball game with the Rangers home run song, the theme from the movie The Natural, playing behind the canned cheering. As for the real human fans, they can't wait for baseball's return. Yasmin Larea took the ballpark tour to celebrate her birthday. It's been a long few months.
It was kind of boring because we haven't got to watch any sports at all. So just watching reruns is not fun.
Longtime Rangers fan Paul Nelson also took the new stadium tour.
I don't know if it's going to finish the whole year, right? You don't know. Yeah, if something major happens, you might have a bunch of guys from the minor leagues playing.
The Rangers' Chuck Morgan worries every day about another interruption to the season.
I would hate for that to happen. It would really be devastating to baseball if we couldn't finish this season and have a season this year.
Dozens of major league players have tested positive for COVID-19 so far, including Rangers' Joey Gallo and Brett Martin. Gallo is back and in the opening day lineup and hoping to hear that fateful music. I'm Miranda Suarez in Arlington.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. Craft breweries in Texas that also operate restaurants are raising a glass after a sudden shift that has to do with what's considered a bar. But others are still asking the governor to change the rules to let them open. There's a lot of confusion here, but one thing's for sure. All this back and forth has craft brewers fearing this might be the end of their business. A survey from the Texas Craft Brewers Guild shows 1 in 3 from across the state fear they will have to close permanently in the next few months. Two-thirds don't think they'll make it to 2021. Governor Abbott's decision to shut down bars was prompted in part by pictures of crowded nightclubs. But just like distilleries and wineries with tasting rooms, breweries and brew pubs say they are quite different than bars. St. Arnold Brewing Company in Houston calls itself the oldest craft brewery in Texas, and Brock Wagner is the founder. Brock, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you.
Brock, there's a lot of back and forth. First you can close, then you can open, then you can close. But if you have a restaurant, the rules don't apply to you. It's just a lot going on. What's the latest?
Yeah, breweries have really gotten whiplashed in this whole government orders that have come down. But the latest was on Friday night at 6 o'clock, I got word that the TABC, Texas Alcoholic Beverage Commission, had changed their interpretation of the 51% rule and were again excluding beer sales to distributors as part of the calculation. So the St. Arnold Beer Garden and Restaurant, which had been a restaurant and then had been interpreted to be a bar, has gone back to being a restaurant, and we're back open.
I see. Well, We're talking about how confusing this has been. Part of the confusion is for those who have outdoor patios, right?
Yes. So there was a guidance that the TABC gave about 2 weeks ago, week and a half ago, saying that you could unlicense your outdoor area and invite people to enjoy beer that they had bought to go on your patio. But then last week they changed direction and said that wasn't ever the intent of that particular guidance. So people had to shut back down, at least from that option. But all breweries are offering to-go beer still, but only ones with restaurants. I mean, we got a victory on Friday, but unfortunately, it's a very narrow victory. It probably only helps about 4 or 5 breweries in the state. But, you know, for us, it's a huge deal and means 75 people's jobs. You know, 75 people are back at work this past weekend for us.
St. Arnold is much bigger than a lot of the 300 craft breweries that are part of the guild. What do you see happening to some of the smaller players? I mean, if the back and forth has, you know, one of the strongest, St. Arnold, kind of shaken and not knowing where the business is going at times, have you heard from smaller players and what are they telling you?
Yeah, I'm very concerned about the industry in Texas. I mean, a lot of the newer places, they just operate tap rooms. So all of their sales, or the vast majority of their sales, come from people coming to visit the brewery, you know, having a couple pints. These people are struggling. We've lost a couple already. And, you know, within the next couple months, if there's not some way that they can really significantly resume their operations, that they're going to go out of business. So it's highly concerning. And, you know, these are businesses that are about passion. People are not going into this business with dreams of getting rich. It's because they love brewing beer, selling beer, talking to people about beer.
What are you guys pushing for?
So allowing people to gather in some limited, responsible, socially distant way would be huge. But barring that, allowing breweries to not just sell beer to go, but actually to make home deliveries is something that we believe would help a lot of the small breweries out there.
Brooke Wagner is the founder of St. Arnold Brewing Company. Brock, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me today.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Austin police have released two people who fired shots in an incident in which a Black Lives Matter protester was shot and killed Saturday night. KUT's Donnie Matias has more.
In a Facebook Live video, a car can be heard honking its horn in a group of protesters when shots rang out. Austin police identified the victim as 28-year-old Garrett Foster, who died from multiple gunshot wounds. Austin Police Chief Brian Manley said last night that Foster was carrying an AK-47 type rifle when he approached the vehicle before being shot by the driver.
After the first volley of gunfire, another individual reported hearing the gunshots and observed the vehicle driving away from the crowd. This individual drew their concealed handgun and fired multiple shots at the vehicle as it drove away.
Manley said both shooters reported themselves to APD. They were questioned and have been released pending further investigation.
Donnie Matias reporting. The Texas Republican Party's new chairman is criticizing the statewide mask order Governor Greg Abbott imposed to reduce COVID-19 transmission. Former Florida Congressman Alan West was speaking with NBC5 Dallas-Fort Worth Sunday.
Of course, I understand when there's an emergency situation, and then at some point in time, you have to come back to the legislature if you want to continue to send out orders or what have you. It has to be done by legislative process.
The Republican governor has faced similar criticism from other GOP leaders. A recent study from the University of North Texas Health Science Center finds face mask mandates significantly reduce the spread of the coronavirus. As Texas public schools prepare for the start of the new academic year, it remains unclear what flexibility districts will have to provide free and reduced meals to the 60% of students statewide who participate. After the governor ordered all campuses to close in March, the federal government approved waivers allowing the state to offer families a variety of options for getting food. Those included curbside pickup and the Pandemic Electronic Benefit Transfer Program, which gives families the cash value of meals their kids would have gotten in school. Rachel Cooper is with the think tank Every Texan. She explains the U.S. Department of Agriculture has still not issued guidance on how to provide food assistance when schools reopen with both in-person and remote classes.
Schools are actually facing a much more complicated situation for the fall, and yet they've been giving way less flexibility than they had back in the spring.
Friday is the deadline to apply for the pandemic EBT program. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
You're listening to statewide news from public radio stations across Texas. This coverage is only possible because of support from listeners like you. You can help sustain and grow Texas news coverage by donating to your local public radio station today.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. Do you have a 10-year plan? How about a 15-year plan? Has that plan been derailed, say, by COVID? Well, the Texas Higher Education Board had a 15-year plan. The goal was for 60% of Texans between the ages of 25 and 34 to have post-secondary education by the year 2030. But that plan has been derailed. And a recent report out of Rice University's Houston Education Research Consortium, which is part of the university's Kinder Institute for Urban Research, indicates the state is not on track to meet that goal. Brian Holzman is research scientist at the Houston Education Research Consortium, specializing in education policy analysis. Brian, thank you so much for being at the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
Do you have an idea of how many Texans currently have a post-secondary education?
So our projections in the report estimate that around 46% probably have a post-secondary credential of some sort that ranges from a certificate to a doctoral degree.
And why is Texas behind? I mean, the goal was very clear. There's a path, you know. Why did we not meet it?
It's a pretty high bar. Mm. The state has made progress over the past several years. Harrison Keller, who is the commissioner of the Texas Higher Education Coordinating Board, has acknowledged he doesn't think that we will be meeting the goal as a state and that the progress has been too incremental. I could speculate on reasons why, but you know, that was not the focus of our report that we released. The focus was to look forward, especially as we deal with the COVID-19 pandemic, which is a public health crisis and an economic crisis.
Well, let's talk about that then. What can the state do to move forward?
Through these analyses and other work I've done at HERC, focus a lot on a couple areas, one of which is college prep course taking in high school.
Okay.
And so we define college prep courses as AP, Advanced Placement, International Baccalaureate, and other advanced courses that students are able to take in high school. We have found that the more of these courses that students take, the more likely they will earn a 2 or 4 year degree. And so, you know, if you compare students that took zero college prep courses in high school, about 9% of them earn a post-secondary credential within 12 years of high school by age 30. If you look at students that took 2 to 3 courses, about a quarter of them completed a BA. And if you look at students that took 9 to 16 courses, two-thirds of them complete a BA.
The curveball with COVID-19, is that something that you guys are factoring in your study?
Yeah, that's an important thing to note. All our projections and all the studies that we've conducted as part of this broader project were done before the COVID-19 pandemic, which was, you know, it's unprecedented crisis. And so I think the COVID-19 pandemic could make things more challenging for the state to reach its goals. I think it means that, you know, we have to really focus more and identifying ways to support students and helping them take college prep courses, deal with any other health or economic challenges that are going on in their personal lives. So I think, you know, additional guidance, counseling supports, and college advising supports are really essential.
Brian, what is your favorite part of this research? I know when I look at research, I always come out with a nugget or two that I absolutely, you know, I'm fascinated by. What is that for you when it comes to this research?
So I think the first part of the study really focused on the 60% benchmark that the state wants to reach by 2030. But the other two parts dig a little deeper into labor market outcomes. And what I learned from that is that in the Houston area, the areas of growth is really the sub-baccalaureate level. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is that the jobs that are increasing in demand, they typically require only about 1 to 2 years of post-secondary education. So that could be a certificate or an AA. And if you look at a lot of these jobs that have been growing in the Houston metro, they're managerial positions, but they're like low to mid-level managerial positions, like compensation and benefits managers. And so that could be a way to, you know, weather the recession, you know, to encourage students to get some education, maybe focus on areas that are in demand. And I think, you know, that might be more essential, you know, given the economic recession.
We've been speaking with Brian Holzman. He is a research scientist at the Houston Education Research Consortium, specializing in education policy analysis. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, offering annual preventative and screening appointments with safety protocols in place. Early detection is critical to better cancer outcomes. More at texasoncology.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Gregory Zerlin. I live in East Texas, near Tyler. I'm an artist, and I write poetry, and I've been married for, just celebrated my 40th year of being married. We started wearing masks even before people were saying that you should, just because my wife's in the medical, is a doctor. She just felt like it was a very important thing to do. So she started making masks, and she made me a goofy kind of checkered black and white one. And we also have, you know, we bought the regular face masks with the, we've got a box right by the door. You know, we've got masks in all of our cars, and, you know, we've got them hanging off the rearview mirrors, and just, you know, I've got them in my pockets. I'm a runner, so I carry one with me if I'm in a situation that could end up being in more crowded with runners. And well, fortunately, when I run, I don't run with other people, and I generally run in places where there's not a lot of the people around, so I don't have to deal with it, because if you're in a big public spot and you're trying to run, it would be pretty uncomfortable, you know, with air restriction and all that stuff. And now it's like more people are doing that. Like, we ran into some people at the park the other day. We were walking, and this other couple we hadn't seen for several years, and they saw us, and we all kind of paused and kind of looked at each other, because they, you know, no one knows if they're practicing social distancing like you want them to, and so they kind of stopped. We hesitated, and we could rest. Okay, they're doing the same thing as us, so we can stand here and they can. I make a lot of different things over the years, of kind of sculptural. The last kind of things I was making were kind of like stick figures, and you know, I probably will end up playing with these masks in different ways, thinking about maybe how the masks made some political divisions amongst people, or maybe the masks can be used as a symbol of learning how to filter some of the thoughts that I should have expressed in the early part of, you know, all this conflict about making masks political and getting frustrated and short-tempered and all that stuff. I'm trying to be more even keeled with all that stuff now. My name is Gregory Zerlin. I live in East Texas.
just outside of Tyler, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
We're just kicking off our Tell Me About Your Mask segment, and we want to hear from you. The goal is to record just a slice of history when all Texans were required to wear face coverings. All stories are relevant, but we're especially interested in hearing about your unique stories or challenges, so reach out to us on social media or send us an email at texasstandard@kut.org. Thank you. San Antonio's 343-acre tree-shaded Brackenridge Park is home to a zoo, the Japanese Tea Garden, the Wiji Museum, and the Sunken Garden Outdoor Theater. It's also home to one of the oddest stories in San Antonio history. Texas Public Radio's Jack Morgan tells us why.
That story starts 50 years ago on the miniature train that runs nearly 2 miles on narrow-gauge tracks, crossing the San Antonio River twice, going through a man-made tunnel, and by the waving tourists it passes. Lily Goodspeed knows well what was then called the Brackenridge Eagle. Her father, Travis Goodspeed, managed the train depot.
He ran the station. He was the man with the great voice and the speaker running the trains in and out. And he'd say, watch it now, watch it now. Get back from the track, you know, and he kind of guided the crowd.
26 years before, Travis Goodspeed was part of the second wave at Normandy's Utah Beach, D-Day. He survived that and went on to fight at the Battle of the Bulge. But all these years later, the tough guy wasn't tough on his daughter.
I go to work with him a lot. I was 10 at this time. We always stopped for donuts. Went to the depot station.
She still wears his World War II dog tags as a necklace. On a hot and sticky July 18th, 1970, though, something odd happened on the train they called Old Smoky.
It was my 11th birthday. We were here with my brother, my sister, my mother and father, and two cousins.
Greg Hargis remembers it well. Just past the tunnel, the train came to a stop.
We were near the back. We heard murmurs that the train was being held up.
What at first looked like a charity fundraising stunt got serious quickly.
As an 11-year-old, I took my watch off and put it in my sock so that I wouldn't get robbed.
Greg's then 8-year-old brother, Jeff.
The robbers were wearing masks. One of them had a gun. One of them had a duffel bag. They were in a hurry.
Some hopped off the train to ditch their wallets into nearby bushes.
I remember hearing the gunman yelling for people to get back on the train.
Our father took the cash out of his wallet and held up his wallet and showed the bandits that it was empty, and they passed him by.
Jeff said the train's engineer then had a brainstorm.
While the robbers were still there and walking down the length of the train, the engineer got on the radio and called headquarters.
One of the guys dispatched into my dad on the radio, and my dad said, you have to be kidding me. And the guy said, we just got robbed. And he goes, are they armed? And the guy says, yes.
Travis Goodspeed was prepared for such eventualities.
My dad clicked off the radio. He opened up a safe and he pulled the gun out. The ticket lady said, Travis, what are you doing with that gun? And my dad said, lock everything down. They're probably going to double back and they're going to probably try to rob the main office here too. So I'm going after them.
They ran multiple trains through Brackenridge, so Travis grabbed another and headed to the tunnel. But Greg said it wasn't in time to catch them.
It seemed like it didn't last very long. It was over quickly. I don't remember being afraid.
The two robbers were soldiers stationed at nearby Fort Sam Houston. They got away with about $500 in valuables and cash, but not for long. They were caught. And given that train robbery is a federal crime, they were given time in a federal pen, 10 and 20 years each. But on this year's July 18th, the Hargis boys were back, this time to celebrate Greg's 61st birthday.
Yes, I brought some cash and I actually brought a watch.
The reason they laugh is because they know that the little train will be robbed once again, this time by reenactors with bubble guns.
I think they're trying to raise money to buy another engine.
In fact, they are. Zoo employees dressed as bandits once again walked the length of the train holding out a bag, asking this time for donations toward a new train. The train that occupies an emotional space for Lily Goodspeed.
It touches my heart. My dad died in 2005 in my arms, and he's been my world, and I spent a big part of my life out there, you know, going to work with him. I fished behind the train station. I went next door and bring him coffee in the morning and hang out with the squirrels. It was so beautiful.
Over time, what's become known as the Great Little Train Robbery is for the Hargis clan a point of family humor.
It has become part of the Hargis family lore. We have revisited this event many times over the last 50 years.
Most articles from 1970 refer to it as being the first American train robbery in 47 years, and it's also history's very last train robbery. I'm Jack Morgan in San Antonio.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas ABLE program, helping eligible Texans with disabilities save and plan for the future to pay for qualified disability expenses with a tax-advantaged ABLE account. Learn more at texasable.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
It's the Texas Standard. A video of a Texas Civil Rights Project lawyer being shoved into an elevator at a McAllen hotel holding asylum seekers, including children, has gone viral.
Can I ask who you are, sir?
Soy abogado, aquí para ayudar. Si necesitas ayuda, dígame tu nombre. Dígame tu nombre, si necesitas ayuda.
If you're detained, give me
Andrew Udelsman joins us. He's the lawyer on the video, and he is the Robert L. Bernstein International Human Rights Fellow at the Texas Civil Rights Project. He's based in the Valley. Andy, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you, Joy. It's great to be here.
Other media outlets have said that the Texas Civil Rights Project was at that hotel in McAllen protesting, but I want to set the record straight. You were not protesting. Why were you there, Andy?
The reason we went to that hotel was to get information about who is being detained there. We had information that there were children being detained by a private security firm.
And why were you concerned about that?
We were concerned that no one knows what's happening to these children, why they're there. And our mission was to get their names and their information so that we could represent them.
Now, in the video, you're yelling for the asylum seekers. You're telling them, give me your names, tell me where you're from. Why are you doing that? What's going on?
We were not being allowed to speak with the children. We were not being allowed to get anywhere near them. Our goal was to get as close as we could to these individuals and ask if they needed help, if they needed legal representation. But we were being impeded. And so my last resort was just to start yelling, to hope that maybe somebody, a child, would hear and tell us some basic information about them so that we could represent them in a lawsuit.
Andy, but I wanted to ask you, because there's so many things here that just don't click. For instance, we're talking about a hotel. We're talking about children by themselves. We're talking about men shoving you into an elevator. But let's say that these men are thinking, whoa, why is this other man that we don't know doing here? Why should we let this man in? Can you explain how none of these things fit together?
First of all, I mean, the first question has to be, why are they detaining children at a hotel?
Yes.
Why are they detaining children at a private hotel? These are children who are under the custody of ICE, the federal government.
Correct.
And so we had a room on the third floor. There was no police or hotel security that was telling us we couldn't travel around the hotel. That was why I was asking, who are you? Are you police? Well, I was trying to ask, what authority do you have to impede my movement? I never got an answer.
And who were these men?
They are a private security firm called MVM Inc. They're contractors that work for the federal government. ICE uses them quite often.
Do children have a right to an attorney, Andy?
They absolutely do.
And why was that right not upheld when you were there?
The government is trying to remove children and asylum seekers in general from this country as quickly as possible. They don't want these children to have attorneys because that would impede their ability to quickly remove people from the country. They don't want to allow people to apply for asylum. So they held them in secret sites, away from lawyers, away from their families, in an attempt to remove them as quickly as possible from the country.
I also wanted to ask you, there are reports that the asylum seekers were removed quickly after that. The station, the Telemundo station reported that they were moved in the middle of the night to another location. And I've also heard reports that hotels are saying we are a place for, you know, respite and a place for we're a place where people should come and find rest. So what happens next with the asylum seekers?
Well, first, that's correct. The children were moved later that night. They were moved at 2 o'clock in the morning. They were led outside and placed onto unmarked vans, unmarked white vans, and they were transported out of that site. We don't know where they are now. Our next steps are, we have a federal lawsuit. We're trying to locate the children. We're trying to ensure that the children receive the legal protections they deserve. And we're also trying to get information about how other hotels, other locations where children are being held. And we're trying to get a federal court to declare that this is blatantly illegal, what the government is doing.
Andy Udelsman is a legal fellow at the Texas Civil Rights Project. He's based in Alamo. Andy, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Joy. It's been a pleasure.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm sure people are talking about this story on social media. That's why our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, is back. How are you, Wells?
I'm doing well, Joy. And you are correct. That story about the detention of asylum seekers, including children without access to attorneys, generating a lot of discussion online. And that includes our Facebook page there. Josh Fredman says, this is just wrong. These are human beings and we owe them better than that, referring to those children apparently being detained there. And Gabrielle Dulmich-Gordon, she asked poses the big question, is ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, following federal and international law or just dumping these folks back over the border, so to speak? So obviously a story with a lot of unanswered questions that's still on many people's minds. You know, another story, another story with a lot of unanswered questions, the situation in Austin that we heard some about during the...
Are you going to talk about the Black Lives Matter protests this weekend?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, still developing story, very tragic. But as we heard in the newscast, a man is dead after a confrontation with a motorist who turned into a crowd of anti-police brutality protesters making their way up Congress Avenue in downtown Austin.
And it wasn't a gun that some of these people were carrying. It was an AK-47, if I read correctly.
Yeah, a lot of different weapons.
Yes.
Yeah, apparently three guns, it appears, be amongst the crowd that day. So the man, the victim, 28-year-old Garrett Foster, was shot by this as-yet-unnamed motorist.
Wow.
And Foster was apparently open carrying a rifle, which, of course, is legal in Texas. Many details still being sussed out, whether the victim pointed his weapon at this motorist that drove into the crowd. And then, as I said a moment ago, this presence of a third gun, apparently someone in the crowd of protesters fired on the car as it left, according to police. Obviously a terrible tragedy and one that folks are still left with lots of questions about. This comment from Facebook, very representative of those questions. Alexandra Perez Puyes, she says, after the suspect drove into a crowd, fired into the crowd, and killed someone, they have been released? With many people sort of left with these questions. And apparently both that individual, the person that fired from their car apparently, and this third unnamed individual who fired on the car as it was leaving, have both been questioned and released. That there was a vigil for Garrett Foster. Jim Ellinger on Facebook notes that about 400 people attended this memorial. Heavy press coverage. So obviously a story that we're going to be hearing a lot more about.
Absolutely.
I would reckon, Joy.
The Black Lives Matter movement continues. Thank you so much for listening. I just want to say that on behalf of the entire team, we're so grateful to you. And this is the Texas Standard. We'll be back tomorrow. I'm Joy Diaz.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.